Access Cast, an Accessibility initiative, presents Unstoppable Mindset, the podcast where inclusion, diversity, and the unexpected meet. Hi, I'm Michael Hinkson, Chief Vision Officer for Accessibility and the author of the number one New York Times bestselling book, Thunderdog, the story of a blind man, his guide dog, and the triumph of trust. Thanks for joining me on my podcast as we explore our own blinding fears of inclusion, unacceptance, and our resistance to change. We will discover the idea that no matter the situation or the people we encounter, our own fears and prejudices often are our strongest barriers to moving forward. The Unstoppable Mindset podcast is sponsored by Accessibility. That's ACCESSIBE. Visit www.accessibility.com to learn how you can make your website accessible for persons with disabilities and to help make the internet fully inclusive by the year 2025. Glad you dropped by. We're happy to meet you and to have you here with us. Well, hi, and once again, glad you joined us on Unstoppable Mindset. We're here today talking with Wesley Haygood, who has got some really interesting stories to tell. And being prejudiced, I will tell you that he has a college degree in mathematics education. So mathematics, that's close to physics. They relate. My master's is in physics, Wes, so I'm prejudiced, but we're glad you're here, and we're glad everyone that you're out there listening. So thank you, and Wes, welcome to Unstoppable Mindset.
Well, Michael, thank you for having me.
We're really glad you're here. I know you've got some great, interesting stories to tell us, and I think you've done some things, and you've been involved in some things that are as unstoppable as it gets. So we'll get to that, but why don't you start by telling us a little bit about you?
Okay, well, thank you. Let's start at the beginning. I was actually born and grew up in Annapolis, Maryland, which is the capital. I worked as a math teacher. Also after that, a computer programmer, computer-based training developer, a management consultant, and I'm finishing my career as a program manager for a large government training program. I married Denise Lee in Annapolis. We had four children there, Katie, Mark, Kelly, and Paul. And my wife stayed home to raise our four children. And then she returned to college and became a science teacher and a librarian. And I would say it was, we were planning to kind of retire early, you know, and travel the world, but we were in our late, sort of mid to late 40s. And I said to my wife, you know, we're getting older. Is there anything in your life that you really wanted to do that you've not yet been able to do? And she said, well, now that you mention it, I want to adopt. That? Yeah, she says, I want to adopt a daughter from China. And I was like, kind of like, no way, because I said, you know, we've discussed this before several times. I said, we have four children. We don't need any more children, right? And, but, you know, after asking her that question, I really didn't want to deprive her of something that was really important to her. But I also knew that, you know, this could not be her project, if you know what I mean. If we were going to adopt a child, I had to be fully on board, right? So you might say, why did my wife say that? Well, when she was back in middle school, one of her social studies teachers was pretty progressive, and he had the kids read an article, either from a newspaper or, you know, a magazine at the time, and it described a place in China called the Weeping Cliffs. And of course, the article was about infanticide. The fathers, the Chinese fathers, would bring the unwanted girls, throw them off the cliff, and then the mothers would return to weep for their lost daughters. And so when my wife heard this story, she was very moved. She was only in middle school, but she said, you know, if I ever have the opportunity, I'd like to adopt one of those girls. So after thinking over my wife's request for a while, I said, you know, I don't want to stand in your way, and I'm willing to kind of help you realize your dream. But if you really want to do this, you're going to have to manage this whole process, because I said, I'm very busy, you know, with my career. And she knew that. And I said, I just don't have time to do it. And my wife, to be honest, is not a, she's a big picture person, right? She's not detail oriented. So I kind of thought to myself, if she really wants to do this, she's going to have to really focus to make this happen. And honestly, I wasn't sure if it was something that was really going to happen, because as I said, I thought she might just be overwhelmed and give up and not go forward, but I was wrong. She must have really wanted to do this. And she successfully managed this process, this adoption process, which the State Department in the US says is probably the most bureaucratic process that the US government has. So to fast forward, after this discussion, a couple of years went by, because it takes a while to gather all these documents, prepare the application, submit it, and then wait for the Chinese government to match you with the child. But in, I think it was October 2003, we went to China and we adopted a little girl named Xin Hong Yi, and we renamed her Mia. And after a few months went by, my wife said to me, you remember that, that discussion about my dream? And I said, yeah. She goes, well, actually, my dream was really to adopt two girls from China. And I said, no way. You know, you never told me that before. You said a daughter. But to be honest, adopting Mia was such a good experience for our family that I was the one who became the advocate to go back and adopt a second daughter.
How old was Mia when you adopted her?
She was just 18 months old.
Okay. So she didn't have a lot of memories of China and her parents.
No memory whatsoever of China.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway, go ahead.
So in August and September 2006, about 3 years later, we returned to China and we adopted a second daughter named Yuan Xiaolan, and we renamed her Mei. Now, today, Mia is a sophomore at Virginia Tech, and Mei, who's a year younger, is a freshman at Delaware Tech. So that kind of brings you up to current current state, you know, where we're at right now.
What caused Virginia Tech and Delaware Tech?
Well, Virginia Tech, because at the time Mia was applying for colleges, we lived in Virginia, and we basically said, okay, you're child number four, and Mia is child number, or you're child number five, Mia is child number six.
And he's a math guy, folks.
You're going to go to a state school, pick one. And she actually ended up getting a full scholarship to go to Virginia Tech. And so that just made the decision even easier for her and for us.
What's her major?
Her major is engineering, and she's focusing on computer science. So shouldn't have too much of a problem finding work after she graduates.
No, and you guys will get along since it's science related.
And math related. That's
and exactly math related. Right. What's May's major?
May is majoring in information technology. So she wants to do something similar, but she's a lot more focused on hardware, and Mia is a lot more focused on software. Mia loves to write code. May actually built her own computer, got all the component parts, plugged them together, and made the whole thing work. I thought this is not going to work, but it actually did, and she's using that computer today.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what about the four earlier kids? So you guys go off and adopt these two children from China.
Yeah,
that had to have a great effect on you, your wife, and the other children.
It was really funny. They all had different reactions. The two older girls kind of said something to the effect of, "What aren't we enough for you?" Something like that. My older son, who was the second child, said, "You're too old to adopt. These kids are going to be running the neighborhood, you know, and you'll be asleep. You won't even know what's going on." And then the fourth child, my younger son, said, "Hey, it's your life. Do whatever you want with it." So it was kind of funny. They all had very different reactions to us adopting children. But they're all very glad we did. And, you know, Mia and May are important parts of our family.
So what happened when you brought each of them home then, and the other kids met them and all that? How did all that go?
They were pretty excited by the time we were returning from China with Mia. It went very well, actually. And the same thing with May. Actually, one of our four children, Kelly, who was the second daughter, third child, she went with us to China on the on the trip. So she was there for the whole adoption process for May, the younger of the two that we adopted.
So did the sisters hit it off even in China?
Well, we didn't take Mia with us to China. May.
No, but May and Kelly.
Kelly. Oh, yeah. Kelly just fell in love with her on first sight, and they got along very, very well.
How old was May when you adopted her?
May was about 3.5 years old. So it was a very different experience because she was like a little person, right? She was speaking multiple Chinese dialects. She was quite formed as a human being and an individual, having had lots of life experiences, even at only 3.5 years old, very different than an 18-month-old who was very much like a baby or a toddler.
Does she have, May, that is, much in the way of memories of being then in China at this point?
At this point in time, she doesn't really have that many memories because remember, she was only 3.5.
Right.
But she told us things about China that we thought were not likely to be true, like just fiction in a little child's mind. Like, for example, when she came back, she told us that she had a little brother. And we thought, okay, that doesn't make a lot of sense to us. But we later found out that she lived with a woman in foster care. And we asked the orphanage about it. And they said, well, the woman has a daughter, but she doesn't have she didn't have any male children. Well, we found out that was wrong. The foster mother actually had a little boy, and May was actually taking care of him to some degree, even though she was only 3 years old when she was in China. And we know that this was probably true because we made contact with the foster mother, found out about her son, and she confirmed a lot of what we knew. Like, for example, at 3 years old, May knew how to wrap a baby in a blanket and hold it and feed it, which we thought was unusual for a three-year-old child. Yeah. But I think she actually took care of her or helped take care of her foster mother's younger child.
How do you stay in contact with like the foster mother or other people in China? How do you do that? Is it email or what do you do?
At first we tried email, but that wasn't a very good way to stay in touch. In China, everyone at that time used an application called QQ, which was developed by a company named Tencent, which you might have heard about, on the US stock exchange. They're a very, very large company in China. And then Tencent actually created a new and better and easier to use application called WeChat, which is what pretty much everybody in China has on their phones today. So it's actually very easy to stay in touch with someone in China.
Do you do actual voice calls and so on, or is it texting?
You can do voice calls. You can send photographs. You can send videos. You can have individual and group video chats. It's very easy to use, very intuitive, and very effective in terms of staying in touch with people.
Sure. Well, and at least that way you really can stay in touch.
You can.
So now you have 6 children altogether.
That's right.
So that's a good number. Mm-hmm. No more adoption plans, I assume.
We're actually a little too old to adopt now in our mid-60s.
Yeah, well, yeah. Yeah, there's only so many hours in the day and so many things to do.
Right.
But
I was going to say, and China won't let you adopt after you get to be a certain age, so you're pretty much done with them.
Boy, mandatory retirement, huh?
Yeah, that's right.
How did the process go, though, in terms of given China, the U.S., different countries and all that, and certainly significantly different philosophies and so on? How are they in terms of being supportive and such for people from the U.S. adopting Chinese children, as opposed to what obviously they used to do with the Weeping Cliffs and so on?
Right. Well, I mean, if you think about today, the relationship between China and the U.S. is a lot more tense than it was at that time, right back in the early years of the new millennium. China was very supportive of foreigners, if you will, adopting children from China. I'd say I've heard estimates anywhere between 120 and 150,000 children have been adopted from China since the 1990s. And I'd say probably 85 to 90% of those were girls. And the Chinese government was very appreciative that the Westerners or the foreigners would come and adopt those children, because the understanding at the time was they just had, an exploding population. They were concerned about bringing the population growth down. They felt like it was necessary for the success of the country to reduce that. And so when they ended up with large numbers of children in orphanages, they were very supportive of people from other countries coming to adopt those children.
I assume that's probably changed some over the years and compared to
It now. Has. It's changed, but maybe for a different reason. In the first decade of 2000, 2005, thereabout, there was a big scandal in the Hunan province about children being essentially brought to orphanages to be placed into the international adoption program. There were actually, claims of children being bought and sold and so forth. And when that story leaked out, the number of children available for adoption entering the orphanages significantly declined. I think most of the people in China believe that if their child was placed in an orphanage, the child would be adopted in country, not internationally. And they were the people in the country were concerned about that. And so after the word got out that many, many children were being moved into orphanages and then being adopted internationally, the numbers entering dropped off significantly. And today, the number of children adopted from China is much smaller than it was, say, around 2005, 2006, which was the big peak when maybe about 12,000 or more children each year were being adopted from China.
What do you think it is today, or do you have a notion?
Today, it's probably closer to 3,000, so it's a much smaller number. And in almost every case, I won't say every case, but in almost every case, there are children with some sort of disability, physical or other type of disability. And so the Chinese government continues to place those children for adoption, but there are just far smaller numbers that are entering the orphanages to be adopted.
But a lot more of them are children with disabilities and such.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. It's interesting. I had the opportunity after my book Thunder Dog was published, which chronicled my life and wove into it the story of the World Trade Center. I went to Japan in 2012 because it was published there and there was a Japanese publisher. One of the things that I learned was that for many years, and I don't know when it actually stopped, but for many years, if a child was born with a disability, they were euthanized. Mm-hmm. It was the standard practice. And no one, I didn't get the impression that anybody was concerned about it, although they did evolve from that. So it is interesting. It's the usual thing about dealing with disabilities, where we're not viewed as equal in the eyes of most people. And it's an educational process. And I hope one that we'll see continue to grow, and that there will be more people both in this country and in the world who will truly and intellectually and emotionally accept the fact that disability doesn't really mean lack of ability. We really need to change that view.
That's true. Absolutely true.
So it's kind of one of those things that happened. Well, Mia, especially, I gather, has been a very significant challenge to you, because at some point along the line, she wanted to learn about her birth parents.
She did. I'm trying to think. I'd say that it was probably when she was about 4 years old, she started asking us lots of questions about her birth parents. You know, she wanted to know things like, what are their names? What do they look like? How old
are
they?
And it was pretty clear that she obviously understood she was adopted.
Oh, yes. She was a precocious child, and she understood, and she was very, very analytical. So she was always trying to figure things out. That's the best way to describe Mia, is analytical. And so, you know, she'd say things like, well, how old are they? Those kinds of questions. And then, of course, probably the most significant was, well, why did they give me away or up to be adopted, right? And we would just say to her, Mia, we don't know. And this went on for months. And eventually, you know, I talked it over with her mother and I said, look, this is clearly very important to Mia. So I think that we should begin a search to see if we could find her birth family. And we told Mia that. We said, look, we don't know the answers to your questions. We know that it's important to you to learn and to, you know, get answers to your questions. So we will go ahead and do whatever we can to search and help find your birth family so that, you know, you can get the answers to these questions that you seem to need so desperately. And we didn't even know. I didn't know at the time if it was even possible to find birth parents in China because, you know, we were given so little information, obviously no information about them. All we were really told is that Mia was found on this location on this date. And that's all we had. It was a place in China called Hongfu Lu, which was Hongfu Road in Chinese. And she was supposedly found there about, you know, maybe 10 days after she was born. And that's all we knew. So, you know, I started thinking about how might we search and tried a number of different things. And then 14 or 15 years later, we actually discovered the identity of Mia's birth family members, and we had it verified through DNA testing.
How did you discover them?
Well, that's a very good question. I tried, like I said, just about everything possible to identify or locate her birth parents. First, I went to China myself and made a trip back to the orphanage, which we had not been allowed to visit when we went to China. We met the children in the provincial capital, Guangzhou. So I actually went to this small, rural, mountainous city and went to the orphanage and was looking for clues or answers and didn't really find much of anything, primarily because they wouldn't let me visit the orphanage because they said, you know, this is not your history. This is your daughter's. If you would, you know, if you really want to visit the orphanage and ask questions, you need to bring your daughter for a heritage visit. So 6 months later, I was back in China with Mia, and we actually visited the orphanage. We got to see her orphanage file. We got to ask questions, and we found the name of the individual who allegedly found her on Hongfu Road. And you couldn't really tell from the Chinese characters the name, whether it was a male or a female. There was no, you know, identifying information other than the name. We tracked down anyone we could find in the city that had that name. And of course, no one knew any information about her and had no knowledge of Mia being found. But that was the first thing. So we took the documents that we were given and or visited the orphanage to find more information. And then didn't really get very far. So then the next thing that I did was to try to, I guess I would call it kind of a media-based search. We tried to put posters all over the area where she was allegedly found in the town on Hongfu Road. And even though I had done that multiple times or had someone do it on my behalf, I did it myself when I visited, no one ever came forward. No one ever contacted us. In fact, even though supposedly five children were found on this very short little street, this very short little road in the center of the city, no one ever remembered any child ever being found there. So that it sort of started making me question about whether it was true or not, you know, was the information that she was found in that location, because I would think that someone would remember at least one child found there if allegedly five had been found there over a period of 4 or 5 years. But it turned out the third technique that I used was the most successful, which I call genetic genealogy-based search. So it involves testing a child's DNA, and then when they match to someone who had a common ancestor, you start building out a like a family tree diagram,
right?
Using a traditional genealogical technique. And you build out these family tree diagrams for everyone she matched to that's a relatively close relative, hoping that the tree diagrams would intersect, you know, and point to her birth family. And what was happening is we were making good progress and we were eliminating paths on the tree diagrams and narrowing in on the birth family And then we uploaded Mia's DNA into a Chinese database, and she matched to a first cousin. So that made it much easier to trace from the first cousin to her uncle and aunt, who had relinquished a child for adoption the same year Mia was born. And the first cousin put Mia in touch with her first cousin's cousin. And it turned out that she looked very much like Mia. She agreed to take a DNA test. And the results came back saying that they were full sisters. You know, they were sisters. And then because I wanted to be sure, I asked if Mia's sister, biological sister, would be willing to ask her parents to take a DNA test just to make sure. Both agreed, both took it, and the results came back, and it said they were her biological father and mother. So we're certain we found the family.
Has everyone been able then or now to visit? And
well, we couldn't really visit. We actually located the birth family in October of 2020. And of course, as you know, the pandemic was in
that COVID thing,
full rage. And but the good thing is, using WeChat, as we talked about earlier, Mia has been able to have video conferences with her birth family members, including her mom and dad and brothers and sisters, like she has one brother and several sisters. And she's able to stay in touch with her sisters using WeChat. So it's not quite being there, but it's almost like being there.
Yeah, it's as close as you can get right now.
Yes, until the pandemic resolves itself and we could actually maybe make a visit to China in the future.
Mia has learned to speak Chinese.
Well, when she was growing up, she would go to Chinese classes, you know, during the week or on weekends. I would take her, go with her, because she was so young at first, she needed support. And when she got to high school, she got so busy, she had to stop doing that just because it was very challenging. And I think she's probably lost most of it. But like a lot of people, when you learn a language, you can recover it very quickly once you get back in that environment. Yeah.
How do they communicate then? Do the people in China speak English, or how does that work?
I see what you're saying. Yeah, her birth parents do not speak any English, but her three older sisters, all of whom, by the way, either went to, or the youngest of the three, just a little bit older than Mia, is still in college. And in China, oftentimes many of the classes are taught in English, or some of them are. Ah. And so at a minimum, the Chinese students have to be able to read and write in English, even if they're not very fluent in speaking it. That's a little harder to do unless you have a partner to practice with. But then of course WeChat has a translation
feature, right?
So you can just, you type a message in Chinese and send it, and then we click translate, it goes into English, we type in English, send it back, they hit translate, although they're pretty versed in reading English, so they don't often have to translate it.
So Mia's biological sister in college, what is she majoring in?
Well, they have three. The one that's still in college is actually a biology major right now.
There you go, science again.
Science again. And then the older two majored in business, and they're both working in Chinese companies.
Well, at least there's a science connection, so that's a good thing. Not as much math in biology necessarily, but still plenty.
Yeah. In this day and age, more math than there used to be, perhaps, in biology.
Yeah. Well, math is kind of the rudimentary thing of all of them. You know, physics is a great subject, but it is so math intensive. Mm-hmm. And what a lot of people never get to recognize is getting down to the philosophies of physics that the math has really helped create. Mm-hmm. And there's so much philosophy in physics about the universe and so on. And it sometimes is helpful to separate the two, but math is important.
Very important. It's almost like the international language.
So Wes, another question. When you found Mia's birth parents, what did they think of the whole thing? What did they think of you searching and finding them and so on?
Well, they were actually quite surprised. Maybe even we could use the word shocked, because they believed that Mia was still living in China. So they did not expect that when she contacted them to learn that she had been adopted internationally and living in the U.S. all these years. So that was kind of their initial reaction.
How are they now?
They're fine. We had our first group video chat using WeChat video on Chinese New Year Day in 2021, and it was great to connect with them and, you know, meet all the members of the family and chat. It was a little noisy because there were a lot of fireworks and things going off in the background because it was New Year's Day in China. But then subsequent to that, Nia had another more quiet conversation just with her and her mom, and then some of the other members joined later. And I think, as I said prior to this, we stay in touch with them using WeChat. And just this morning, I was chatting with one of Mia's older biological sisters about whether they celebrated the Qingming Festival, which is known as the Tomb Sweeping Festival in China, which occurred on April 5th. And it's where you go and you clean up your ancestors' graves and sort of offer sacrifices and things. And the older sister, Junie, said, no, we couldn't go this year because of the pandemic.
Yeah.
So that's still playing havoc with family traditions in China.
Yes, it is everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So how is it then that Mia ended up being in an orphanage? What happened?
Well, the Mia had three older sisters, and when she was born, her family, primarily father, decided to give her to a woman who wanted to adopt a girl. And actually, Mia's aunt played a big role in transferring her from her mom and dad on the day Mia was born, actually, to this woman who lived in a remote mountainous village in Xinyi City, which is where Mia was born. And as far as they knew, Mia was still living with that woman and part of her family all those years later. They're not certain how or why the woman somehow must have transferred Mia to the orphanage about 10 days after she was born. They don't really know, and they've lost touch with this woman. So you could see why they'd be surprised when Mia contacted them and said she'd been living in the U.S. all these years. It's funny, we had actually produced a video as a way to try to reconnect with Mia's family in China, and had it put on some websites there when Mia was about 8 or 9 years old. And Mia's aunt told me, oh yeah, I remember seeing that video. She said, but I'd never thought it could have been Mia because we knew Mia was still living in China. So she never even realized that the video was of her niece.
Wow. Yeah. Circumstances and strange twists.
Yes.
Well, I assume that at some point Mia wants to go back and visit and reconnect physically.
Yes. When Mia first learned about the identity of her birth family, one of the first things she said is, do you want to go visit? But as I said, that was back in October, November of 2020. And as you remember, the pandemic was pretty much raging then, and there wasn't going to be really any likelihood of traveling to China. Of course, things got a lot better into China until recently with the arise of the Omicron B2 variant. And now, as you've probably heard, it's spreading quite a bit throughout China. Last count I heard, there was at least 24 provinces that had that variant. And for example, they have shut down Shanghai, a city of 26 million people, trying to test everybody and continue their policy of zero COVID in China. So because that particular variant is so transmissible, my guess is it's going to be quite a while before they actually bring it under control or get the situation resolved, and it would be possible to travel to China again.
Well, it'll be a joyous and certainly a good day when Mia can actually go back and see them. So I
exactly. Yeah.
I hope to hear about that once it occurs.
I know. We're looking forward to it. But as I said, it's going to be a while, I have a feeling.
It'll happen, though.
I think so. I believe that.
You in going through the whole search and so on, you documented it as you went along, or how did you keep a record of it all?
Well, what happened, I think I mentioned I sort of semi-retired in about a year ago in June 2021. And for, I'd say, about 2.5 years prior, I had started writing a book. And the title of the book is Searching for Your Chinese Birth Family. And the purpose, I wrote it to benefit the 120,000 Chinese adoptees and their adoptive parents who began adopting those girls, mostly girls, a few boys, but in the early 1990s. And the idea was to really to share what we had learned during our family's journey with others who might want to do the same. Really, there was no roadmap, Michael, when we started this, right? There was really very little online even that you could find about how to go and search. And so I had to think long and hard about how would we actually be able to do this, right? And I think my first thought was, well, I need to find an investigative reporter in China. That was my thought, who speaks English, right? Because I did not speak Chinese, who would be willing to undertake this project of sort of, searching for my daughter's biological family if I would help fund it. And I couldn't find anyone who would be willing to, accept that challenge, right? So my next stop was, well, okay, I at least need to be able to speak to this person. How about an English teacher? Someone who speaks fluent English who might be willing to help. And I actually found a couple of English teachers who were willing to go out, ask questions, hand out flyers, that sort of thing, trying to get the word out that Mia was trying to reconnect with her birth family. And
These were
the
teachers
idea was to
in China.
teachers in China, in the
Okay.
city where Mia was found.
Right.
But the
Okay.
idea was to document all of everything that we tried that didn't work, as well as what did work, and create a framework so that people who were either considering launching a search, or maybe they needed to reinvigorate their search because they tried a couple of things and felt hopeless and had stopped, give them that big picture, that frame of reference of how can you do it? What are the different ways to search? What are the most effective ways? What are the advantages and disadvantages of each type of search, right? And I documented all that in a book that I, like I said, started writing about 2.5 years before we even found Mia's birth parents. So it was really an act of faith that we were going to that the process that I was following, which at that point in time was the genetic genealogy based approach, that the testing of DNA and matching to other individuals, and then trying to understand who their living relatives and ancestors were, and creating family tree diagrams and so forth, was going to pay off. And it eventually did. And it was actually accelerated when we found that first cousin, because we knew exactly what to do in terms of what questions to ask. We had been building relationships with people from China for quite some time and documenting, the relationships. And we were able to go pretty quickly once we found that first cousin.
You documented it all. You got all the information. How did you go about writing the book then? Did you do it all yourself? Did you get someone to help you with that? How did all that work out?
No, I pretty much wrote it all myself, day by day, little by little, sentence by sentence. Eventually, I reached out to a publisher, Heritage Books, who I thought might be interested in publishing a book like this because they are known to publish books about genealogy and family history. And I was actually surprised when I sent a query letter out, and I think I sent a couple of chapters that I had written at that point in the book. And they came back to me and said, yeah, we'd like to publish the book.
And what company was that again?
It's called Heritage Books.
Heritage Books.
And
Okay.
Heritage Books. And they're well known for publishing genealogically, genealogy and family history types of books. So people that are interested in doing research about their ancestors, right? They're known for publishing books on that topic. And this book sort of seemed to fit, right? Because I was advocating using those types of processes to actually trace from living individuals to back to ancestors and then forward again to the birth family. And so they were interested, and they basically just gave me their guidelines and in terms of the format and all of that. And I met their requirements and sent the book in, and they published it, and it came out this past December. So it's really only been out a little over what, December, January, March, a little over 3 months, going on 4 months now.
How long is the book?
It's about 132 pages.
Okay.
It talks about the document-based search that I described earlier, the media-based, the genetic genealogy-based search. I then kind of advocate for that third type of search as the one that, if you really want to make that connection, that's your best chance of doing it. Because the first two types, although they've been successful, it's rare that you'll be able to use the documents that China gives you, or even other ones that they retain that they don't give you unless you go back to China, inquire, and ask for a copy. It's very rare that you're going to find a birth family that way.
Of course, the whole concept of the whole concept of genetic genealogy and so on is sort of the same thing that has been used effectively and very famously in terms of solving some criminal cold cases and tracing back the genealogies through genetic coding.
That's exactly right. And if you look prior to solving those cold cases, people were using and they developed this concept called genetic genealogy to fill in gaps in a person's family tree. And then someone in a police department read about it and thought, I wonder if he could use that same technique to find solve a cold case and find someone who had committed a crime.
Yeah. And the famous person who did it, and I don't recall her name, has been a very famous consultant and works with police departments all over, but she proved the whole point of what was doable, and it makes a lot of sense. And certainly it makes a lot of sense to be able to go trace people like you were and are trying to do. And obviously you need a little bit of cooperation on all sides, but it certainly is an exciting way to do it.
That's right. That's C.C. Moore that you were.
Yeah, that's right. C.C. Moore, yeah. Right.
She's very, very famous. In fact, she was one of the individuals who I believe coined the term genetic
I think she
genealogy.
Did. Well, you know, you obviously put a lot of effort into this, and as much as anything, the emotional effort to make it happen. So you clearly were very committed. Does it surprise you now, thinking back on it, how committed you were, given the fact that your wife just sprung this on you one day?
I certainly knew that I was very committed, right? Because in some sense, I had put off doing other things that I wanted to do in my life, because I felt like it was really important for both of our daughters that were adopted from China to be able to have that, you know, have that knowledge and to reconnect with their first family, their birth family. And so I was committed to doing it. And we're still searching for May's birth family using the genetic genealogy technique. You know, we're trying to be patient, continue to periodically check all the databases. Her DNA is in a number of them. And at some point, I believe that she will match to a fairly close relative. And once that happens, if that individual will cooperate and share information with us about their living relatives and ancestors, we should be able to trace from those individuals to May's birth family. And to be honest, the likelihood of that occurring increases every day, because these databases continue to get larger and larger and larger. And C.C. Moore was one of the people, and others, Blaine Bettinger is another big name in this field, who realized that once just 1% to 3% of a population has their DNA tested, just 1% to 3%, if you have yours tested, you're likely to match a close relative, which I think is bizarre, but that's all you need. And then
are there databases in China? I'm assuming that yes, somehow that's the way it goes.
There are databases in China. In fact, there are many more than there are in the US or in the West. But the Western databases, ones that you'd be familiar with, ones like Ancestry.com, 23andMe, MyHeritage, those family tree DNA, they're much larger, much larger. And in China, this is still a relatively young industry, if you want to call it that. They call it direct consumer testing. And so the largest DNA database that I know of, which is the one that we put Mia's DNA in and she had the match, is a database called 23MoFang, which means 23 Rubik's Cube. It only has 600,000, only 600,000 users. And so in some sense, we were quite fortunate that Mia matched to someone, since they've not yet gotten to the point where they've tested even 1% of the Chinese population of 1 billion people, right? They've got a ways to go. But like I said, every day, the likelihood increases that you'll find a match. the challenge with China is getting your DNA into their databases. And as I said, they're so small that the likelihood of a match or a close match is not high. But at some point, just like in the West, those databases will, someone will dominate the market, maybe two or three companies, and they will become very, very large. And then if a Chinese adoptee tests with one of those databases, they're almost certain to find a close relative and we'll get a match. And you know, hopefully if that person will cooperate, we'll be able to trace from that individual to their birth family.
Rubik's Cube is an interesting way to help name a database like that. And it makes so much sense because mm-hmm. it's all about so many different permutations mm-hmm. to get somewhere.
Exactly. Exactly.
Which of course tempts me to ask the question, did you ever have any success at solving Rubik's Cubes, especially with any kind of speed earlier in life?
Personally, I hate physical puzzles. Mia loves it. Mia was one of those kids that you could, you know, mess up the Rubik's Cube and hand it to her, and within just a couple of minutes, she could put it back in shape. I was never quite like that. What I like is solving, the type of puzzle that we focused on with Mia. You know, like you've got a problem and you need to find a solution, which means you need to build a methodology to apply it to the problem to come up with a solution. That's what I really enjoy, and I'd say that's what I've done for most of my career, which was spent in consulting. You know, that sort of thing. Yeah.
So Mia hasn't taught you the intuition of how to solve a Rubik's Cube, I gather.
She hasn't. I have no desire to learn it.
Well, I like some physical puzzles because they're a real puzzle. And I'm not mm-hmm. thinking so much of jigsaw puzzles, but real puzzles like that have a lot of intuition and some creativity behind them. But there's nothing like being able to solve puzzles like what you did. And I love those kinds of puzzles. That's, I guess, from a reading standpoint, that's also in part why I like a lot of mysteries, although I like really the well-written ones, because there's a real puzzle there. And the trick is to solve it before you get to the end of the book. And there's some authors I can do that with. Mm-hmm. So their mysteries have become less interesting, but there are some that I thought were some of the greatest puzzle creators that I've ever encountered, because mm-hmm. I've never been able to come anywhere close to solving them until we get to the end of the book. And then it really is obvious. And there were just things I didn't pick up on.
Sure.
But puzzles are great. And they do tend to challenge the mind.
Exactly. And that's the type I like the best.
Yeah. Well, I guess that comes for both of us from some science backgrounds. We do deal with a lot of puzzles, and the more we solve, the more we develop our own mindsets and our own brains, and the more curious we become. I know I've been curious my whole life, and that's a good thing, to be curious.
I agree. Absolutely.
You clearly have demonstrated an ability to be curious and be patient about allowing your curiosity to take you wherever it goes. Mm-hmm. All of your kids the same way, and your wife?
You know, I don't know if I'd say curious. I hadn't thought about that. The first thing that comes to mind when I think about all of our four older children is that they're all extremely hard workers. That also applies to Mia and May. They're all very hard workers. And I'd like to think that that's because we gave them an example and a model to follow.
Well, and that's, of course, always a good thing, to be able to be a good role model. And that's something that I think kids need in general, and we need to be the role models to bring them to where we would like them to be, which is successful, anchored, and so on.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And mature, moral people, which is very important.
So it's an ongoing process, needless to say. Well, tell me a little bit about, if you were to talk to people about this whole concept of the unstoppable mindset, and what does it mean to you, and how would you encourage people to go about developing a greater mindset? And I deliberately use the term when creating the podcast, unstoppable mindset, because I believe that it is. For me, it started in thinking about surviving the World Trade Center terrorist attacks on September 11th. And what I never understood at that time, and even for many years afterwards, was I knew that I was focused and calm during the escape, clearly not seeing what was going on, but also recognizing it didn't matter that I didn't see what was going on. And that's something that's so hard for people to understand. But the airplane hit in our building, 18 floors above us on the other side of the building. So the reality is, in the environment where I found myself going down the stairs, no one knew. We were all in the same boat. But for me, what I realized in going through the process was I stayed focused, and it took a while to recognize, well, I did all that because I had learned what to do in an emergency. I had consulted with the Port Authority people. I had consulted with fire people and others, and not only learned what the procedures were in case of any kind of an emergency, but also learned all the physical information that I could learn. And it eventually just kind of clicked into a mindset. To me, I knew what I could do, and I knew that I knew everything that I could know. Even so, I asked myself the question many times, anything else you think you ought to learn or anything else you ought to inquire about? And sometimes I got new ideas and went and asked about them, but it created a mindset. Right. So when September 11th attacks happened, I just started observing and drawing conclusions and reacting to those rather than just being panicked by the fact that somebody said, I see fire and smoke and millions of pieces of burning paper above us, and we got to get out of here right now.
Right.
So how would you advise, or what would you advise people about unstoppable mindset and that whole concept?
Yeah. Well, I would say this, for sort of the vast majority of my career, I worked as a management consultant, right? And sort of the definition in my mind of a management consultant is a person who, in my case, advised government managers on how to think about and improve their processes, find a better way to work, be more successful, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we had to do was be comfortable with ambiguity, because, as you said, after the events occurred on 9/11, there were a lot of things that you just didn't know. You didn't know what was happening, right? And so I think you have to be comfortable with ambiguity. It's not easy. We all like certainty, right? We don't like ambiguity, but you have to become comfortable with it. And I'd say in the world in which we live, we have to be comfortable with things not being clear, but at the same time, as you said, not panicking, thinking about what we know, what we don't know, what's the best way to go forward, what are our goals, how do we accomplish them? And I would say that, you know, if something's really important to you or to your family, you should never give up. You should just stick with it. That doesn't mean you have to burn yourself out, right? You can take breaks. Like when we were searching, there were times where it was so exhausting, you just needed to take a break and go off and do something else, have a picnic, you know, whatever it was, you know, take a day trip, right? Take breaks, but don't quit. Don't give up. Stop periodically, assess what you're doing. Ask yourself, is this working? Is it leading me any closer to my goal or not? If it isn't, then try a different approach. And the final chapter of the book is called Our Story. And the reason I put it at the end of the book, well, there was two reasons why. Number one, I've read books about searching for birth parents, not Chinese birth parents, but just in general, you know, like in the US, for example, or something. And people sort of interleave their story in with the process, and it makes it very confusing. And it's almost like a tangent, right, that takes you away from, well, what are the steps I should be following? I didn't want to confuse the readers with that. So I put it at the very end of the book saying, look, here's our story. If you read this, at the end, you'll have a better understanding of the process we followed and why we, you know, why I came to the conclusion that this one approach was the best approach to search. But also I put it there because I wanted them to understand all of the things we tried that did not work, and that despite failure, if you will, we never gave up, right? It's really like you would say, the unstoppable mind. Okay, that won't work. Let's try this. That won't work. Let's try that. There are a lot of revelations in the book, things that I tried or almost tried, that that didn't make a lot of sense, but I wanted the reader to understand. We've tried just about everything possible to give them the context and understand that what I'm advocating, what we're advocating as a family, will work if you stick with it, right? We've tried all these things so you don't have to. Think of it that way. We've failed many times so that you can make a quicker, you can move more quickly to success. And so that would be my advice, right, to someone in terms of developing an unstoppable mind. And I would like to add, I think you should also pray for God's guidance. I'll tell you, my wife spent years praying. She spent far more time praying that we would eventually find me and May's birth families than I did. Not to say I didn't pray, because I certainly did, but I probably did more physical work. She did more praying. And I think it was the combination of those things that also helped us eventually get there and sustain us, you know, through the arduous process, if you will.
I wonder how much praying she did to get to the point of having the wisdom to approach you and get you to come on board, and then praying for you to be a part of it. There had to be prayers there too. But the power of prayer is really important. And I think that whether God says it or not, life is a puzzle. And you demonstrate so vividly the concept of solving a puzzle. And people will come along as time goes by from reading your book and maybe listening to this podcast or just from their own experience, and will add more to the puzzle solution, which is what makes this so exciting. One of the most important things that I have learned, and you talked about ambiguity and so on, one of the things that I find most important to say to people is, don't worry about what you can't control, focus on what you can. And that was a message that I got and is talked about in Thunderdog, where I believe, well, I know God spoke to me because it was a very physical speaking to me, which is something that I think is hard for a lot of people to understand. But there are things we don't have control over. And if we fret about that and spend our time worrying about that, then we shift away from dealing with what we can and making things better. And the reality is, what we can control will get worked out one way or another. We just don't have any control over it. So why should we spend a lot of our energy on it? It just gets frustrating.
And that's a good message to remind others and remind ourselves of often, right? That, what does it say in the Bible? There's a passage about not being able to like extend your height by a little bit or your life by a single day, something to that effect. So why worry about those things, right? Focus on what you can control, what you can do.
The rest will take care of itself. So if people want to get a copy of your book, well, actually, before we do that, I want you to, if you will, talk a little bit about FCC.
Oh, FCC, yes. FCC stands for Families with Children from China. And I am the president of the FCC chapter in the capital area. So Washington, D.C., serving families in Virginia, Maryland, and D.C. And we were a group of families that just sort of self-organized, like I said, back in the sort of like maybe mid-90s as adoption from China started to happen on a more regular basis. And really, the purpose of it was to help other families who were seeking to do the same, to help them understand the process, what it would be like, and to create a community for those families who had done something that was really rather unique at that point in time. And it's grown to the point where there are chapters, they're each sort of individually structured all over the US and really all over the world. But then as the number of adoptions has declined from China, and the children that were adopted as infants often, right, or young children have grown up and are now in their teens or maybe in college, maybe even young adults outside of college, the chapters have started to decline, and a number of them have are inactive, right? But most still have a Facebook group or something so that you can get in touch with them if you'd like to do so, especially for families who are still continuing to adopt from China.
Is there a website?
Best thing to do is just go to Facebook and type Families with Children from China, and you'll find them pop up all over the place.
So yes. There isn't like an FCC.org or familieswithchildrenfromchina.org?
There was one like that, but that one's even defunct now.
Okay. And,
it wasn't a, how can I say this? It wasn't a single organization. It was a collection of organizations who all had kind of a common purpose.
Right.
And tended to use a common name, but each individual one was individually chartered, usually with the state in which they were located.
So there wasn't a confederation or as you said, an individual organization. They were just groups that formed, obviously with a very common and relevant purpose.
Exactly. Yeah.
And, well,
part of what they also did was to help, help the families and the children learn about Chinese culture, Chinese customs, et cetera, because that's something that we all promised when we adopted those children, that we would raise them with knowledge of their country, their culture, their customs, that sort of thing.
Well, if people want to get your book, how can they do that? And if people want to reach out to you and maybe talk with you or gain more wisdom from you, how can they do that?
Okay, well, the easiest way to find the book is just to go to Amazon Books and search for the title. And the title again was Searching for Your Chinese Birth Family, Searching for Your Chinese Birth Family. And then if they wanted to reach me, the easiest way would just be to send me an email to my Gmail email address, which is my name, Wesley, middle initial O, last name Haygood, @gmail.com.
And Haygood is H-A-G-O-O-D.
That's right, H-A-G-O-O-D. No Y in Haygood.
Well, that is really so cool. And I'm really glad that you came on to tell your story. I think it's an important story for people to hear. And you obviously enjoyed the adventure, challenges and all, and you obviously demonstrated a very strong, unstoppable mindset going through all of that in any way that implies.
Yeah. Well, Michael, thank you so much for having me on your podcast show. It's great. Great to be with you.
Well, I enjoy it. And hopefully if you find other people that you think would be good guests, no matter the subject, we'd love to hear from them. If you want to come back and talk about engineering, we can do that. Or whatever. You and I both have worked long enough with the government, however, that there are probably a lot of government contracts we can't talk about. Otherwise, we would no longer exist in the world.
That's true. If you're like me, you signed a statement that you'll keep this information confidential for the rest of your lifetime. So
what information is that? So I used to sell products to SAIC and to other government agencies. And I worked for a company that made products, and we had a lot of fun, but some really interesting, very quiet contracts, and that's okay. Yeah. I'm all for security when it's relevant to do, but it's a lot of fun to have had you on, and clearly you have demonstrated some great things that I think will inspire people. So I really appreciate you doing it. And for those of you listening, love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, Michael Hingson. You can email me at Michael H-I, M-I-C-H-A-E-L-H-I, @accessibe, accessibe.com. You can go to www.michaelhingson.com, michaelhingson.com/podcast to hear other episodes, or you can go to any place where you find podcasts. And if you found this elsewhere, go there and you'll find the rest of the Unstoppable Mindset episodes. And please give us a 5-star rating. Please say positive things. We appreciate that. But I'd love to hear any thoughts that you have. And if anyone out there listening has ideas for guests or you want to volunteer, please do so. Love to hear from you. Wesley, again, thanks very much for being here and for giving us a lot of insights today.
Thank you so much, Michael.
You have been listening to the Unstoppable Mindset Podcast. Thanks for dropping by. I hope that you'll join us again next week and in future weeks for upcoming episodes. To subscribe to our podcast and to learn about upcoming episodes, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/podcast. Michael Hingson is spelled MICHAELHINGSON. While you're on the site, please use the form there to recommend people who we ought to interview in upcoming editions of the show. And also, we ask you and urge you to invite your friends to join us in the future. If you know of anyone or any organization needing a speaker for an event, please email me at speaker@michaelhinkson.com. I appreciate it very much. To learn more about the concept of blinded by fear, please visit www.michaelhinkson.com/blinded by fear. And while you're there, feel free to pick up a copy of my free ebook entitled Blinded by Fear. The Unstoppable Mindset podcast is provided by AccessCast, an initiative of Accessibility, and is sponsored by Accessibility. Please visit www.accessibility.com. Accessibility is spelled A-C-C-E-S-S-I-B-E. There you can learn all about how you can make your website inclusive for all persons with disabilities and how you can help make the internet fully inclusive by 2025. Thanks again for listening. Please come back and visit us again next week.